ethnicity and education, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for part four in a series of programs for Black History Month. You'll hear from Julius Chambers, Chancellor of North Carolina Central University, and Philip Richards, a professor of English at Colgate University. Philip Richards is here to discuss the origins of African American literature. Before that, Julius Chambers talks about minorities and education in the United States.
I think we still occupy a very disproportionate position in terms of the number of minorities who are going on to higher education, who are receiving degrees, and who are pursuing graduate and professional studies. It certainly is not commensurate with what non-blacks are doing.
Julius Chambers, Chancellor of North Carolina Central University. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about ethnicity and education. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Of all the pressing social needs that we face today, the education of our young people is arguably as important as any other, and it's especially important with regard to our minority students. Yet, regardless of ethnicity, sustaining the connection between education and productive citizenship is difficult. For Black History Month 1994, the leader of one of America's noteworthy historically black colleges is here now to talk about that connection. Julius Chambers is Chancellor of North Carolina Central University. Before he accepted that position just over a year ago, Chambers was a civil rights lawyer and directed the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, where he argued dozens of important cases, including several before the Supreme Court. But that experience wasn't without its surprises. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, in the late 70s, Julius Chambers protested the pace of integration in the educational system of the state of North Carolina. He even went so far as to question the need for historically black colleges and universities, such as the one he now presides over. Chambers says that today, this nation's historically black colleges and universities face a double dilemma. They must overcome the historical fact of discrimination, and they must do so in an atmosphere of financial constraint. Against that background, I asked Julius Chambers to reflect on minority education in the 90s.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of villains. I think that historically minorities have been limited in educational opportunities and haven't had the resources that others have had in order to pursue undergraduate, graduate, and professional degrees. I think, too, that now that opportunities are opening up, there is a need for these individuals to be advised about these opportunities and encouraged to pursue those studies.
Mm-hmm.
Third, there is a real problem that limits opportunities of minorities, and that's the problem of finance. Many simply don't have the resources to pursue undergraduate or higher education. And those resources are slowly becoming available. In terms of affirmative action, I don't think we've done enough of it. I think in the early 70s, some efforts were being made to provide affirmative opportunities for minorities in higher ed. And I think we should reach sort of the maximum of that effort about the mid or late 70s.
Would you say that affirmative action is itself a kind of, is it a victim of the vicissitudes of politics, or are we talking about human nature, that is, making a sea change in the way the American people look at their minority populations?
I think it's more the former. I think that this country reacted violently in many instances to efforts to bring minorities into the mainstream, and affirmative action was sort of picked as the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a major assault during the Reagan years on affirmative action, and a number of schools, watching the Department of Education abandon ship, simply dropped affirmative action efforts. More recently, we find that a number of institutions are reaching out more and trying to bring more minorities into the fold.
How do you react to the proposition that minority education in this country serves several masters? That is to say, the critics will point at people like you, and they'll say, well, what you're doing is not educating students. You are attempting to create in them a kind of an ethnic pride or an ethnic identity. Are they polarities? Are they compatible? How does this work?
I think that the HBCUs that I know are providing a significant educational opportunity, and they are focusing on education. And I think more so than other institutions, they are doing a lot to teach people how to live with others. I find on most of these campuses more efforts to provide a kind of multicultural educational opportunity. There is first the substance of the education that's needed, and then there is the community outreach and the interrelations among people.
Is there a danger in the word Afrocentrism, Chancellor Chambers?
I don't think so. I think that it's important for various ethnic, racial groups to be proud of their ethnicity and their race. Mm-hmm. And I see no problem with advocating that. I think that we also teach, that is the HBCUs, that with that pride, we have to respect the pride of others in their race and their ethnicity.
Talk to me for a couple of minutes, Chancellor Chambers, about the relationship between minority education and the black community as a whole. As I read the newspapers, there is, again, there's a lot of harmony, but there is also some criticism, some tension between these two groups, shall we say.
I think there is some, and I think there is some justification for it. But I don't think the minority institutions are unique in this respect. I think we saw some of that dissension or in the recent bond issue in North Carolina, mm-hmm. With a number of people questioning whether the state ought to provide the kind of resources that the bond issue would have provided. Much of that, I think, comes from the failure of institutions, including the minority institutions, to do more outreach in the communities, to try to provide some resources for addressing some of the major issues in the community.
Well, let me be specific. My sense is that among some black kids, urban, rural, you can put them together, come up with a combination. To make a long story short, it's not cool to be educated. Now that is that a minority within a minority? Is that the kind of thing that we need to worry about when we talk about educating our youngsters?
Well, I think there is some of that. Obviously, and I think it's largely in the elementary high schools.
But you live with the results of that after a fashion, do you not?
Well, I think that we see some of that, some of the results. But I think on the whole, from what I've seen of our students at Central, there is a real interest in trying to get an education. Uh-huh. And there is less of the ostracism from some people who say that those who are pursuing an education are elitist, etc. And I think there will be less of that as the institutions begin to reach out more in the community to provide some kind of support and answers for the problems the communities have.
Mm-hmm. Chancellor Chambers, what's your responsibility as one of the very noteworthy leaders in minority education in this country, not only here in North Carolina, but I take it that you want to set some standards and set an example for what's going on in the rest of the country? How about this?
I think that's crucial. I think that we have to ensure that our students are better educated. And we have to begin in the elementary schools or even beforehand. And we have to help them appreciate the need for studying early and really becoming prepared to deal with the market tomorrow.
Did you read a lot when you were a kid, for example?
I did. I joined a book club as early as 14 or 15.
Did you feel any pressure because of that? Any peer pressure?
No.
Were you
no.
criticized?
No, not uh-huh. at all. I studied hard through elementary high school, through college, through law school, graduate uh-huh. school. And I think I, by doing so, encouraged others to do the same.
What do you say to kids, particularly who live in large urban areas, who have such a tough time coming just to the proposition of education, much less the challenges of learning, the challenge of learning itself? How do you get them into the pipeline? What kind of plea do you make?
That in tomorrow's market, people are going to be judged on their training and their ability to perform. Mm-hmm. We have no more handouts. Even with affirmative action, it will have a lot of limitations in the future. One is going to be offered employment. One is going to be accorded privileges based on what one can contribute. And in order to be able to contribute, one is going to have to be educationally prepared.
What about the criticism that the black family is not doing its job? Yes, we have the creation of a black middle class, but that black families themselves are at risk, and therefore education of our minority students is at risk.
There's certainly some truth to that. I don't think, though, that the black family is that unique in that respect. I think we see that same problem among whites and others. But I also see in the black community some major efforts, even within the family, or particularly within the family, to deal with some of these problems that we are talking about now in trying to ensure that students are motivated to become educated.
Do I take it, therefore, that you are essentially optimistic? I assume that you wouldn't be doing the job that you're doing if you didn't have a measure of optimism. Why are you optimistic?
Well, I'm optimistic because I believe that bringing a message to people about the need for an education, talking with them and sitting down, rationalizing with the about the problem, will encourage people to do things. Mm-hmm. I've begun to see that now at North Carolina Central. I've seen it at another number of other institutions, and I think we just haven't said enough to people in order to motivate that kind of concern.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Mm-hmm. Chancellor Julius Chambers, what would you say to the parents of the kids who come to your school, North Carolina Central? Not only black kids, but white kids. What is the message that you're passionate about as you speak to the parents of the next generation of kids?
I think it's sort of threefold. The first one is, it is absolutely essential that all of us become educated. Gaining knowledge about history and sciences, among other things, and knowing and being competent in those areas is crucial. Second, it is essential that we learn how to live together. This world is much more complex. We have a number of different races, a number of different ethnic groups, and they all are seeking the same kind of respect. Mm-hmm. And we're doing very little in terms of teaching people how to live and learn and respect others. And that's crucial, and that's what we're trying to do at North Carolina Central. The third thing is that I think it's important that the university reach out in the community and help or try to help as much as possible with the problems that are confronting the community.
You set up a special office, for example, to deal with this kind of challenge.
We have, and I hope that within the next year or two, we will make it mandatory that every student commit at least 30 or more hours per semester as a condition for graduation to community service.
You're back to an old-fashioned word like volunteerism, aren't you?
Yeah, a bit so, and I think that's crucial at this day and time. I hope, though, that students will want to do these things. And what I've found is that in the few months we've had this program in effect, we now have over 1,000 students who have volunteered. And I trust that within the next year we'll have the whole 5,000 or 6,000 students enrolled volunteering to do this kind of work.
Chancellor Julius Chambers, I want to thank you so much for coming by the National Humanities Center, taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us for Black History Month 1994. You are Julius L. Chambers, Chancellor of North Carolina Central University. Thank you, sir. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part four in a series of programs for Black History Month, The Origins of African American Literature. Join me now for a conversation with Philip Richards, a professor of English at Colgate University. In his scholarship, Philip Richards looks back to American culture in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries. He's writing about two African-American literary figures, Jupiter Hammond and Phyllis Wheatley. According to Philip Richards, both Hammond and Wheatley struggled to express themselves in an atmosphere largely shaped by early American nationalism and by a social ethos of Christian piety. Some scholars contend that African American literature has its origins as a rebellion against white and Eurocentric models of art and human behavior. But Philip Richards argues that it's also important to recognize the cultural background, the vocabularies of art and politics that underscored the creation of African American literature. I asked Philip Richards to talk about Jupiter Hammond and Phyllis Wheatley in the context of early American nationalism in a world shaped by white Christian males.
I think the critical thing is that in the late 18th century, a number of political and social languages exist for defining the essence of nationalism, that we can think of nationalism in Puritan or evangelical terms as a covenant nation, as a group of people with whom God has made a promise and with whom that promise carries on from generation to generation. We can also think of nationalism in terms of a republic, as a group of citizens sharing virtue who act for the good of the whole. What I want to argue is that that's the source of Wheatley's conception of nationalism. When she thinks of nationalism, she thinks of a covenant nation in the same way as the American revolutionaries begin to think of their new nation as a covenant nation. She thinks of her country as a republic demanding certain virtues of her citizens, of its citizens, and that the racial restrictions that hedge around those words in 18th century society begin immediately to become important because of that. It's not normal for blacks to see themselves as part of the white covenant nation.
Well, indeed. I mean, we have here an enormous paradox or contradiction, because here is a writer who represents an oppressed minority,
right,
attempting in her writing to acquire a vocabulary of the majority culture. How did she struggle with that?
Well, I think that what she found and what many early Afro-American writers found was that the language was implicitly ambiguous and capable of many possible meanings. It was possible to think of a black nation, as she did occasionally and as Hammond did, of covenant people in a kind of covenant relationship with God, brought over from Africa in the same way that the Englishmen had been brought over from England, and therefore in a parallel situation to the new nation. Or it was possible to think of them as sharing the same religious values roots as whites. And so the origins of double consciousness, as W.B. Du Bois might put it, are really in the ambiguities of our political and religious languages.
Well, does that mean that somebody like Wheatley is able, in literary terms, to forget what we call the Middle Passage, to put all of that racism and oppression behind her?
Not to forget it, but rather to interpret it within the ideology of her time.
Uh-huh.
That within the ideology of her time, the Middle Passage becomes, as it becomes in Hammond, a sign of God's providential choosing, of a sign of God's intention to bring her to a Christian nation. This isn't a very palatable reading of the Middle Passage right now, but I think it's a plausible reading if we think of the importance of Christianity to her as an ideology that explained her entire existence.
Well, now, we got a lot of abstractions at work there. How is it that if Phyllis Wheatley, and to a degree, I suppose, Jupiter Hammond, subscribed to the language of the white majority, how is it that we can genuinely give them, therefore, an African-American literary identity?
Because African-American is African and American,
mm-hmm,
because African-American demanded some kind of articulation in the New World, and that articulation in the New World could only come from the languages and ideologies available. I think it's very significant that Phyllis Wheatley never gives us a Wolof word.
She never gives us what?
A Wolof word. Uh-huh. She comes from Senegal. We never hear any Wolof. We never hear, uh-huh, any of the ethnic names that 18th century people in Newport and Boston were certainly aware of in the newspapers, but which never show up in her poetry. As a matter of fact, her representations of Africa are just as traditional and just as generic as what we see in Dwight or in Philip Freneau.
Mm-hmm.
These
would be
Timothy Dwight and Philip Freneau, two late 18th century white male poets. She's very much in line with her culture in terms of the way she represents Africa.
How does the work that you're doing, Phil Richards, that is to say, placing people like Phyllis Wheatley and Jupiter Hammond in the circumstances of their own time, and then asking them, as it were, to travel across the ages to our time, how does this word speak to, how does that work speak to a term such as multiculturalism? It sounds to me like you're telling me that this is a very old phenomenon.
I certainly think that it's an old phenomenon in America. And I think that the great danger that we face today is that we've inherited Afro-American literary traditions since the Harlem Renaissance that want to displace and suppress the origins of Afro-American literature because they're so grounded in the ideologies of their period that they appear to be assimilationist.
Uh-huh.
We want to displace these early writers because they depended so much upon patronage that they undermine the idea of an autonomous or an independent literature. In doing that, I think we're simply evading relationships of power and political contradictions that are always going to shadow Afro-American literature. We're simply forgetting what we don't want to know. And I think that the danger of our current readings of these earliest writers is that we will not receive the truest self-knowledge we can get from the study of literary history by repressing part of our past.
How should we teach African-American literature in the 1990s, Phil Richards, not only to black children, but to white children as well? That the critics say, for instance, that this kind of thing gets taught under the rubric of a sort of vague self-help movement, giving our youngsters a sense of ethnic pride, and that, in effect, substitutes for the hard work of education. Is that a fair criticism? What do you think of it?
Well, I think that ethnic self-pride is probably a part of a lot of literary canons. It's certainly a part of the American literary canon. We tend to, in the past, we've tended to dramatize, to prop up American literature when it seems to be most independent, and we've tended to denigrate it when it seems to depend most on Anglo culture. I think we're involved in running the same risk of American exceptionalism now with African American literature. We're repeating the American paradigm,
right,
in an ironic kind of way, pushing for an African kind of exceptionalism. And I think that you're right to say that the same kind of therapeutic, possibly chauvinistic impulse is there. The danger there is that, as I said, literary history should give us a kind of self-understanding that transcends our immediate prejudices as much as we can. We can never completely transcend them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we're always doing that.
Let me get personal with you for a moment, Phil Richards. I mean, here we are, two sort of little fat guys. My skin happens to be white. Your skin happens to be black. Does that mean that because of that so-called racial difference, that I'm never really going to understand the burden, the perils, the rewards, the pleasures of what you called your literary inheritance in a way that I understand mine now?
I think the great opportunity of literature is that it lets us into other people's cultures. And the danger of much literary canonization and much of literary politics is that it inhibits literature from doing what it can do, it inhibits literature from letting us in and inhibits our experience of literature.
Given the kind of work that you do, looking at 18th century, 17th and 18th century writers, African-American writers, and moving that forward in time into the literary culture of the 1990s, are you optimistic about how literature works to move us toward racial harmony? Is that too big an order?
I'm increasingly optimistic because I think that the more literary critics of African-American literature there the more of the possible interpretive positions will be filled, and we'll eventually get to the most plausible ones that the critics will sift things out. And I also think that people want good literary criticism in the end, that they want a literary culture that enhances their experience, that they've had enough of what the media gives them, and that at some point they're going to want to come back to the heart of literary experience, literary culture. Literary criticism is part of that.
Phil Richards, I want to thank you for this overview of your work. Let me tell our listeners about you and about your work. You're Philip M. Richards. You're a professor of English at Colgate University. You're spending the year at the National Humanities Center working on a project with the tentative title, The Ideological Origins of American African-American Literature. Have I got all that right?
Right.
Phil, I appreciate your time here on Soundings, and I certainly wish you well in your work.
Well, thank you very much, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's program. You've been listening to the fourth and concluding segment in a series of discussions for Black History Month 1994. My guests were Julius Chambers, Chancellor of North Carolina Central University, and Philip Richards, a professor of English at Colgate University. For a cassette tape of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 700. That's program number 700, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again, 27709. Next week, the first in a series of programs for Women's History Month. Over the next 4 weeks, my guests will include scholars from the University of Illinois, UNC Chapel Hill, and Columbia, Harvard, Princeton, and Duke Universities. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.